Hey, good afternoon, morning, evening, whatever. This is the Dr. Zero Trust, I don't know, show, podcast, whatever the hell this thing is that I do on the regular. I've got two authors here from a book called Battlefield Cyber, which it's on Amazon. It's on a whole bunch of things. It's actually got an audiobook I saw as well. So if you got time and you're looking for something interesting to read, go check it out. Michael and Bill, why don't you guys give just a quick background on who you are and tell us why you wrote the book.
Beauty before age, Mike.
I appreciate that, Bill. Yeah, so my name is Mike McLaughlin. I'm a cybersecurity attorney with a law firm called Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney in D.C. Prior to practicing law, I served 12 and a half years in the Navy, where my last tour was a senior counterintelligence advisor for U.S. Cyber Command, primarily working with our cyber protection teams going overseas in the lead up to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so now that I'm out, I assist companies going through ransomware attacks, business email compromise, and all other sorts of cyber horribles. So that's me. Bill?
Well, I started off being on the ground in China in 1979 when Deng Xiaoping and Jimmy Carter normalized relations. So I lived in Hong Kong and Beijing, and I followed U.S.-China relations for all those years. And along the way, I started covering technology as well. So the intersection of China and technology is what something I've been following for a while. And our expertise, our collective expertise matches up so well because we're different, dramatically different backgrounds, but also that Mike has the technology insights and also the governmental insights that I simply don't have as an outsider to government. And so I also have some areas of strength that Mike doesn't have because he doesn't live and work in China. So together, a lot of people say that the combination of our life experiences and our expertise is what makes this book so distinguished, we think.
So having lived in China, what do you see as the state of China in the current, 21st century? Is it totally different than when you were there, or is it just kind of more of the same with technology layered on top?
Well, I lived in China at a time of great hope and under Deng Xiaoping, and who I actually saw him. I was in the same room with Deng Xiaoping once. But for 30 years, we had Chinese leaders who wanted to have China emerge economically and fit into the world order. We had Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, and Hu Jintao. And so they represented a particular kind of Chinese communism that was okay with the idea that a private sector would blossom. They were okay with the idea that the state government would have a slightly different role than the Communist Party, and that there was an entirely different era of wanting to sort of fit into the world order. What we didn't realize is that Xi Jinping comes from a different branch of the Communist Party. He's a hardcore Marxist-Leninist, and he does not believe that China should fit into the world order. He wants to create a new world order with China at the heart of it. That's what he calls China's dream. So we missed this. We in the West missed the signals that this guy is fundamentally different than his predecessors. And so we're just now waking up to the fact that he represents a different brand of Chinese communism and is determined to and believes that the capitalistic West must be destroyed. So this has been called one of the worst foreign policy mistakes of the century. We didn't know who this guy was.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems like China is just growing as fast as it can, and they don't play by the same rules that we do in the U.S., and that puts us at a disadvantage. Is that a fair assessment? Is that, line with what you guys think?
The game they're playing. We are yes, no, black, white thinkers. You're either our friend or our enemy. But they have, with 5,000 years of written history, they are capable of playing a kind of game, kind of strategy that we don't understand. And so we're losing the confrontation, because we're locked in this very simplistic mindset. They're our friends, right? Xi Jinping wants to meet with Joe Biden, right? Everything's going to be okay. We're going to stabilize the relationship. But what we don't seem to recognize is that they're on using technology, and in large measure, technology, it's a technology-led offensive to undermine us, to steal our technology, to confuse us through social media, through false and disinformation and misinformation. So it's a full-scale digital assault on our position in the world and our the fabric of our democracy and our indeed on our national security, and we don't seem to be able to recognize it.
Well, and I think it's beyond being able just to recognize it. And we're fundamentally not structured to respond to it. And so you see what the Chinese historically have done, and this is since 1949, but they're now on their 14th five-year plan. And these five-year plans look out at the economy, and they look out at where they need to go, where they need to grow, both militarily and from an economic perspective. They have these five-year plans, and they very much stick to them. And so as they move forward, they're able to take the long view of things. They're able to take the long view of how do they control their command economy? How do they pivot their command economy such that it puts them in the best position vis-a-vis conflict with the United States at any time, but certainly over the next 10 years. We, on the other hand, are looking things at best a four-year horizon that corresponds with the presidential election cycle. And at worst, we're looking at quarterly profits in the corporate sector. And until we get outside of that mindset, we're really not going to be able to compete effectively with the Chinese.
One of our problems, Chase, is that we have a public sector and a private sector, and we believe that there are certain things the private sector should do, make money, of course, and that the government does not have the right to audit their IT systems of defense contractors, the DIB, Defense Industrial Base. So we have 300,000 companies in the Defense Industrial Base, and they resist the Pentagon's efforts to audit their systems or have third-party auditors look into their systems. So, but as a result, the Chinese are in there. The Pentagon is not. Chinese are in deeply into our Defense Industrial Base, stealing such things as the designs from the Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier class. They rolled out a new aircraft carrier called the Fujian, the dead ringer for the Gerald R. Ford. So they've stolen, are stealing from us on a massive scale, and we just don't see it happening. We can't stop it, partly because of this gap in our system. We are a pluralistic society. We don't believe that the government has the right to intrude on the private sector and vice versa. But that our pluralism, our openness is one reason why we're so vulnerable.
Well, I think we learned a lot during the COVID crisis that the government can flex pretty hard when it wants to. And I mean, that I think that was one thing that kind of woke people up to the way that technology and technologies can be used by government organizations to kind of restrict some of the freedoms that we value so much and also, and push on the individuals. And I mean, I'm not a crazy tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist person. Like, I've just been kind of crawling back through things and looking at it and going, it works when you've got a bullhorn as loud as the internet is and you've got all this technology. It works pretty well for suppression, for promotion, for use of that. And then, tangentially to that, you throw in the way that, like you're talking about, that China is doing what it is doing. They're a lot better at this than our government ever is or ever will be. I would say that seems to be pretty much the common agreement across everybody is China's really, really good at what they're doing. And the U.S. is basically not.
Right. We have not really begun a serious response. I mean, this is pretty incredible. Our government is not organized the right way. And Mike will tell you in detail how many different centers of digital expertise exist in the government. But we created a cyber czar in the White House level, but the position is empty. Chris Inglis left it out of frustration with fighting with Jen Easterly and what's the other one's name at the National Security Council? And Nuremberger. So we have squabbling between the Department of Commerce, which has the NIST, and that's one center of expertise. Then you have the CISA in the Department of Homeland Security, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Nobody's in charge. There's nobody in charge of the digital strategy inside the U.S. government.
Well, I mean, who wants to be in charge of this Rubik's Cube from hell, right? I mean, you're like, how would you ever say that I'm running things when the system itself is built to be bifurcated and siloed? And I mean, Mike and I were military, we were NSA people. Like, we've seen the internal machinations of what goes on there with title authorities and COCOMs and all the other things going on. I want to also ask, the title of your book, just so that everybody gets to it, because we started going on to this, is really Battlefield Cyber, How China and Russia Are Undermining Our Democracy and National Security. So let me ask the question sort of the same about Russia. China is pretty good at this. They are very strategic, and they are very proficient at the way that they're going about it. Russia seems like they're kind of all over the place and just opportunist. What's your assessment on the Russian side of this equation?
So it's not, sorry to clear my throat there for a second. It's not that they are better, worse when it comes to certain aspects in cybersecurity or cyber warfare or information warfare. They just do it differently. And that's really the critical piece to understand. And so in the book, we try to highlight what the threats are, highlight some case studies about what the Russians and the Chinese have done historically to showcase their different capabilities and what they define as cyber warfare, where we define it very narrowly. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But with Russia in particular, the difference between Russia and China is Russia is willing to go up to that line. You know, there's the famous line in the Batman movie where some people just like to watch the world burn. In a lot of cases, that's Russia. Russia is, for all intents and purposes, a third world country with nuclear weapons, because they have a GDP that's roughly the size of Texas. And if it wasn't for their nuclear weapons, no one would take them seriously. And we, the United States and NATO, very likely already would have responded with great force to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But the fact that they have nuclear weapons, the fact that they've demonstrated the intent and the willingness to conduct destructive cyber operations against critical infrastructure, and I'm specifically talking about in Ukraine with the wiperware that we saw early last year, and then even prior to that with NotPetya, which caused $10 billion worth of damage worldwide. The fact that they have demonstrated they have the willingness to do that, to go to those lengths, has really put us on our heels in such a way that we are restricted in our operations and our ability to respond in kind to Russia for fear of what might happen. Because when you have somebody like Putin in power, you don't know if he's going to pull the trigger with the nuclear weapons. You don't know if he's going to go to that nuclear option. You don't know if he is going to utilize the backdoors that they've emplaced in our critical infrastructure and actually turn off the lights in one of our cities. And that's a risk that in a lot of cases we have to factor into our calculus, that our adversaries don't necessarily have to calculate or have to factor in, because they know we are not willing to go to that unrestricted warfare phase. China, by contrast, is doing it. They have, I would say, more advanced capabilities than the Russians. They just do things differently. And again, it's because they look at the long war, or they look at the long game. And so China is looking to penetrate our corporate networks to steal intellectual property, to develop an advanced military that they have said by 2049, the 100-year anniversary of the establishment of the Chinese Communist Party, they will have the premier military in the world. And they're on track to do so. But they're on track because they have been stealing our R&D, and they've been reverse engineering all of our technology for decades, going back to the early 2000s. And we have the indictments to show that. And so the Chinese are looking at it from a long game perspective. They want to be a global hegemon, where Russia just wants to be respected in its sphere and to restore the respect and the stature that they once had with the Soviet Union.
Well, I mean, we can thank Rambo for bringing Russia down, right? I mean, he was there in Afghanistan. That was kind of when Stallone shows up and makes a movie about you, that's pretty much game over for the whole thing. Maybe he should make a Rambo 5, you know, Rambo takes on China. I don't know, that would bring him down. Hey, but
you know, well, don't forget Rocky 3.
Oh, that's true.
Rocky 3 was, yeah. So he took the Russians down twice.
Right. Yeah, that was Rocky 4. Actually, Rocky 3 was
Rocky 4. You're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
If we're gonna go pop culture, we got to make sure we're accurate with it. So,
Chase, let me follow up on what Mike said, that the Russians and Chinese are profoundly different in many ways, and are in different positions entirely when it comes to wealth. Chinese are sitting on $3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, have all the money that they could possibly need to sustain their strategy for at least a decade. The Russians are broke in many respects. They need money, which is why they're the leaders in the ransomware attacks that we're seeing. They need the money. The Chinese don't do so much ransomware. But what the common agenda they share is to undermine our faith in our own institutions and to steal our technology, as we mentioned. But the Russians are particularly skilled in a way that I don't see the Chinese in playing our wedge issues against each other. my favorite example is the single Russian intelligence agency that created two websites, both in the English language. One website said, all teachers in American schools should carry guns. Then that website was infiltrated or drifted into the information ecosystem we have now in this country, consisting largely of social media. Then the other website said, it's sacrilege to think that teachers should have guns in schools. That's crazy. So these two websites then insinuate themselves into Americans' discussion and start arguing with each other and intensifying the debate. The Russians understand the abortion fight. They understand these issues better than the Chinese do. The Chinese propaganda and social media is aimed at undermining the American intellectual and moral legitimacy in the world. The Chinese like to concentrate on how we subjugated our Native American population or how COVID had a disproportionate impact on African Americans. So they have a different strategy, but the common ground between the two of them is it's aimed at undermining our legitimacy in the world, undermining our confidence in our own institutions, and undermining the idea that we're a single people, a single nation, dedicated to any common purpose.
Well, they're doing a hell of a job at it from everything I can, you know, look at. It's every day it seems like there's additional twist on that whole narrative going on. I mean, the cleaving between the parties seems to get worse almost on a daily basis now. And it's funny to me because, I mean, I'm a student of looking at what's going on geopolitically. And if you take a step back and you just look at the trends in the space, you'd have to be blind not to see the impact that these sort of covert clandestine attacks are having on, you know, the psyche, the collective position of the United States. I honestly think that we are at a space where we're no longer the global superpower. We're still a powerful nation, but it's the fall of Rome seems to be lining up more and more all the time. And it's going to happen because of the continual undermining of these organizations at this speed and scale.
Well, and Chase, it is the undermining of democratic systems worldwide. It's not just the undermining of the United States. So the primary threat to China, to Russia, to Iran, to North Korea, to Cuba, to Venezuela, to any of the autocratic regimes worldwide, the primary threat to them is a democratic society. And so if you have a strong democratic society where people are free to voice their opinions and free to think outside of the box and to challenge the status quo, that is going to be a challenge to any autocratic regime. And they know this, and they look at the United States and they look at the West and they say, we can't allow our people to do this. And China and Russia have both done an incredible job at clamping down on any sort of opposition. China, for instance, they've established a digital firewall, the Great Firewall of China, that is surrounding their entire network. And so they are able to throttle internet access. They're able to censor internet access. They're able to control what goes in and out of their digital ecosystem. We can't do that. I mean, we have a fundamental difference of opinion when it comes to what freedom of speech means and what individual civil liberties mean. And so for the Chinese and the Russians, that just doesn't exist. Well, that does two things. Number one, it sets them up in an incredibly strong defensive position, because if we were to try to penetrate the Chinese digital ecosystem with information warfare, we wouldn't get past WeChat. Why? Because WeChat requires you to have a state ID in order to get access and to get an account, or you have to be authenticated by a trusted member, somebody who already has a WeChat account. Well, what about Facebook? What about X? What about LinkedIn? What about TikTok? All of these different accounts, you can have 700 different accounts under your name or under 700 pseudonyms, and you can be pumping out information at the speed of bots, at the speed of AI, and nothing is going to stop you except for LinkedIn, Twitter, or LinkedIn, X, Facebook, and TikTok, and what their algorithms say when they're trying to go after and find this fraudulent activity. But as a nation, we're not really doing anything to defend against it. We're leaving it to the private sector. So inherently, we are not in as strong a position as the Chinese when it comes to misinformation. The other aspect of it is we don't do ourselves any favors. We are, by definition, a very divisive society. And we love our very strong viewpoints, and we love to argue those very strong viewpoints. And if you don't believe me, just go to New York and ask anybody their opinion and take the other side of it. And Bill, that's for you. Bill's from New York, so I got to poke him a little bit. But I mean, it's that's who we are generally as a people. Well, the Chinese and the Russians know they don't need to concoct wholly new ideas. They just need to champion ideas that are already existing in American culture. And guns in schools, that's a great example. The George Floyd murder, that was a great example. Black Lives Matter, that was a great example. All they do is they jump in on both sides of the argument and they fan the flames of dissent, and then they watch as Rome burns. And for us, we're too dumb to recognize it, and we just jump on it. We sit in our echo chambers on social media. We eat up what the Russians and the Chinese are fanning, and we use that and we champion those ideas, which causes more division, a greater divide within both our political arena and our society in general. And who wins? Well, Russia and China.
Chase, the Chinese have already started using AI, artificial intelligence, to generate content that is broadcast and disseminated in this country. This is on the front page of the New York Times. I'm not just making this up. That they used AI to create messaging about the fire in Maui, in Hawaii, and saying that it was part of a government test of a weather weapon, a new secret super weapon. And so they're promulgating the idea that the U.S. government agencies, unknown, undescribed, but the government did that intentionally. So it feeds into the sense in Hawaii that the mainlanders, the white people, are against the native Hawaiians, and it feeds into all sorts of negative downward spirals. But the fact that they've started doing this, everyone should be concerned about that, because it threatens the integrity of our democracy. It threatens the integrity of our ability to make decisions about how to define what's true and what's not true. So we are on the receiving end of increasingly sophisticated AI-fueled disinformation war. It's a war.
Yeah, and I think that's something really important, is that the days of like the stupid misspellings and the overt stuff of like, there's no way an American or a person that speaks English wrote this, that shit's gone. Because now all you got to do is go to ChatGPT or whatever else. And I mean, I tested it myself the other day. I went and had ChatGPT write something for me in Cyrillic, and I don't speak a lick of Russian. And from what I read, from what I put together, it was solid. So they can do that on the other end. I tell people, and I mean, Mike, you know, you were in the intel health space with me. I tell people all the time, you give the U.S. government and the U.S. intelligence agencies way too much credit. They're not good at what you guys are telling them that they're good at. Like this disinformation and all this other conspiracy theory insanity, that's not the U.S. government. They're not able to even come up with that shit because they're not that good at it. It just doesn't work that way. It's coming from outside, and they're sowing the seeds of discontent because there's a focused effort with 100,000 people behind it. If you think the U.S. can do the stuff that they're preaching about and putting in front of you, you're nuts. It's not how it works.
One source of resistance, Chase, we often get when we speak is that, well, you're talking about what the Chinese and Russians are doing, but aren't the Americans doing the same thing? Our three-lettered agencies, aren't they doing exactly the same thing? So I try to argue that, yes, the CIA and NSA have certain tools, certain tricks they possess, zero-day exploits, all that. But it's an asymmetrical contest, because we're a wide-open society, our information system is wide open, and we have a large presence of Chinese Americans, and so the Chinese government is very cynical about exploiting some members of the Chinese American community, and they have a great firewall. So we can't do the same. We cannot launch the same scale and sophistication of these kinds of shadow wars that they're waging against us. So both of you guys have been on the inside of American agencies. Perhaps you can elaborate. Is it a symmetrical contest taking place, or is it asymmetrical?
No, I mean, we play by so many rules, and there's so much stuff that gets in the way of the way that you operate, that it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I without getting myself in trouble, being in special access programs and other stuff, like it would literally make people scream and throw shit at the wall if they saw the way that the internal machinations of the intelligence apparatus works. And you'd sit there and go, why the hell can't you do this? I mean, this is just tangential to the whole thing, but I can tell you from personal experience, I've worked targets at NSA and then was collaborating with folks in other agencies who I won't name because I'd get in trouble. But because of certain things that occurred, they couldn't do anything about it because they didn't have the legal authority to actually act on it, even though we knew that they were people that needed to be removed from planet Earth. And you sat there going, I know I'm reading this person's messages. They're going to do bad things. But because of certain things taking place and certain legalities, nothing was allowed to occur. And sure enough, like human life would be lost because of those inactions. And it, if you think about it at a one, it's happening at agency level scale. And what's really sad is the people that do the work are amazing. The people that are inside of these agencies in general are the smartest, most dedicated, patriotic people you'll ever meet. But they are tied to the floor by the bureaucratic legal processes that sit above them that don't allow them to do their job. It is crazy. And then on top of that, you've got this whole, you know, hiring the right people thing. When I retired out of the Navy, I was going to go work at Langley, and they offered me a job as a clandestine cyber guy. And funny enough, I made more money as a chief in the Navy than I would have made hanging my ass out on the line doing foreign intel work in the CIA. It's like, really, this is how we're going to build this and you know, take the fight to the enemy? Come on.
So our legal system also is set up in a way that protects individual rights, or those countries, of course, don't give a damn about individual rights. But here's another favorite example of mine. General Nakasone, Mike's former boss, testified that Chinese and Russian actors are able to come into the United States and rent servers and rent computers, use those computers to launch attacks throughout the United States. And so the NSA sees what's happening and other agencies see what's happening, but because they're on domestic servers, domestic US computers, they have to go through a process of getting permission to take action. And by the time they get permission to take action, the foreign powers that have been conducting this activity have shut it down and gone away. So, I mean, that's another example of just how profoundly vulnerable we are.
Yeah, let me give you an example of this. And Chase, this will ring true for you. And this is purely a hypothetical, but it illustrates the authority gaps that we have, or not even the gaps, it's just the seams that exist between our agencies. So let's say hypothetically, you had a nation state. And in this case, let's just say Russia. You've got Russian state-sponsored cyber actors that are coordinating, meaning like the GRU or the FSB, Russian Intelligence and Security Services, in coordination with ransomware actors who are operating within Russia. Both of those groups conduct operations against companies in the United States. Both of those groups, while they're in Russia, the NSA can collect SIGINT against them all day long. CIA can collect against them. Anything, any aspect of the US intelligence community or our intelligence apparatus can collect against them all day long. Well, here's the problem. In cyberspace, both of those groups would then touch a hot point or a virtual private server or a virtual private network within the United States. As soon as that traffic touches that IP address inside the United States, all collection from the intelligence community has to cease. You cannot continue collecting against it unless you get approval by the FISA court, the FISC. And so because of that, where's the handoff? Well, then it gets to the FBI and law enforcement. Well, the FBI and law enforcement, in order to go get the financial information that would be required to trace back where that IP address or who funded or who purchased and paid for that IP address for attribution, they would have to get a warrant to go, or a subpoena to go to that company within the United States and get that information. All of which takes time because they have to go and get that from a magistrate. They have to provide clear and convincing evidence of the fact that this is wrongdoing and a criminal activity. And then they would go and they would get the subpoena, or they would get the warrant. They would be able to collect that information. Well, by the time that happens, the Russian cyber actors, whether the FSB or the GRU or the ransomware group, is long gone. They've already conducted their operation against either the U.S. company or the U.S. federal agency. They've exfiltrated the data to another hot point in the United States that the FBI, oh, by the way, would have to go get another warrant to go access. And then they've already exfiltrated the data. So by the time we're able to do anything, either identify the activity or effective or mount an effective response that we could actually stop it in its tracks, the threat actors have already gotten into our system and have exfiltrated. Well, here's another wrinkle to it. If it's FSB, if it's GRU, well, that's a nation state conducting that activity. That's either a military operation or that's an intelligence operation, but that's something that we as a government have jurisdiction over. We as the military and the intelligence community would have jurisdiction over. Well, if it's a ransomware group that Russia has plausible deniability of saying they are directing or that's operating as a proxy actor for them, that ransomware group or Russia cannot be held accountable for what that ransomware group is doing. So if it's the FSB or the GRU and they conduct a destructive cyber attack against critical infrastructure in the U.S., U.S. Cybercom would be able to respond against Russia, whether it's against that specific unit or against critical infrastructure in Russia as a military operation under Title 10. Well, if it's a ransomware group, we don't have a right of self-defense against a non-state entity. So Russia is using these proxies, these ransomware groups, to target and to weaken us. And we don't have an ability to mount a response other than have the FBI indict these guys in a foreign country for, with whom we have no extradition treaty. And there's no possibility of them ever actually seeing the inside of a U.S. jail. So where is the penalty for these ransomware actors? I'll throw one final wrinkle into this whole quagmire. So that's the authorities piece and why we're losing the cyber war with a country like Russia. The other wrinkle in this is the fact that we are throwing all of these different sanctions at Russia for their illegal war in Ukraine. And we are trying to cripple their economy. Well, Russia has some really, really good IT workers. I mean, they have some of the most advanced technology workers in the world, anywhere in the world. And I don't think anybody would argue that. Well, what happens when you stop, when you cut off all supply for upgrades to software, upgrades to hardware? You're crippling their economy, so companies are going out of business and no longer need IT workers. Are these guys gonna just go panhandle in the street? Are they gonna go take menial labor? No, they're gonna turn to cybercrime. They're gonna take the skills that they have and they're gonna put them to good use. And Russia is welcoming them with open arms. So one of the unintended side effects of us sanctioning Russia in this war is we're actually creating more cyber actors, more ransomware actors that are in turn going to target our companies, which is why the ransomware crisis in this country since the start of the Ukrainian war or since the start of the war in Ukraine has skyrocketed. And that's what we're seeing. And all of this, it's not just cybercrime. This is a geopolitical strategy that Russia is undertaking and that we are losing the forest for the trees because we're trying to go after cryptocurrency. We're trying to go after the Black Cat ransomware group. We're not going after Russia and holding Russia accountable for what is occurring within their border.
Yeah, every time I see somebody post something about we took a ransomware operator down, I'm like, nope, they'll be back. Like, come on, man. That you might have pissed them off or you may have made them have a bad Friday, but give them 30 days and they'll be back. This the way that we deal with it is kind of, and I want to ask a couple questions about what's going on in the battlefield cyber side of the Hamas, Hezbollah, Israeli thing. Because number one, I want to say publicly, like, I totally abhor everything that's gone on with the Hamas and Hezbollah folks and whatever else. I'm glad to know that there's a carrier battle group parked off the coast there. They should get what they deserve because they're doing horrible, horrible things. And I support the Israeli people. I've got a lot of friends that are Israeli. I think they're doing, the best they can, and this whole thing is just totally jacked. So that's number one. But number two, the thing that's interesting with disinformation and the cyber side of this equation is, I I've said this a lot, and I think you guys agree with me, cyber has now become the bridge between espionage and kinetic conflict. And folks kind of should have known. They keep talking on the news about the gaps in the intelligence collection and whatever else. When you started seeing the targeted defacements and the escalation of cyber within that area of the world, they should have known it was getting ready to step up to the next level. I mean, we saw it with Estonia. We saw it with Ukraine. When you start seeing digital saber rattling, basically kinetic conflict is coming in a very near future. And that's what's going on. And then lastly, the stuff that started to happening with the Hamas terrorists doing what they're doing and being very public about what's going on, you know, the pictures they're sharing and the absolutely terrible things that's being publicly put out there. Isn't that kind of, or isn't that just disintegrating their position as the victim in this whole thing? I mean, they're no longer able to say, well, we are just sitting here minding our own business and the Israelis are blowing up our homes. I mean, they're publicly putting this stuff on Twitter and TikTok and everything else. The disinformation is not even disinformation because they're doing it to themselves. Their narrative is falling apart.
Yeah, and there's another information war going on, and it's happening digitally. So, and the Russians were clearly involved. They took down the Jerusalem Post in a DDoS attack. So the Russians were involved, were the Iranians involved, Mike?
They were. Threat Avengers is an Iranian proxy group. Uh-huh. And so it's an Iranian activist group that is aligned with the government. This is the problem, and this is kind of what I was getting to with the ransomware actors. Because we've got these criminal groups or these activists that are not officially under or acting at the direction of a nation state, we can't definitively say, well, that's an Iranian cyber group or that's a Russian cyber group. So in the lead up to the Hamas, all the rocket attacks that launched against Israeli cities, you had Killnet, which is a Russian hacktivist group that has been very active in the war in Ukraine, targeting Ukrainian infrastructure, doing website defacement and DDoS attacks. You had Anonymous Sudan, which, don't let the name fool you, is absolutely not Sudanese, is another Russian hacktivist group that's been very active in the war in Ukraine, again, targeting Ukrainian critical infrastructure, targeting Ukrainian government websites, targeting NATO websites, launching DDoS attacks. But these groups have been very much aligned with the Kremlin, very much aligned with Russian interests. And then all of a sudden, right in the lead up to Hamas launching these rocket attacks, Anonymous Sudan, Killnet, and then the Threat Avengers, which is a group out of a similar hacktivist group out of Iran, started launching DDoS attacks, website defacements against Israeli government sites to include Iron Dome. All of this was in a few hours right leading up to the Hamas attack. And so, Chase, you talked about, well, aren't they shooting themselves in the foot? To my mind, the only reason why Hamas would be so brazen in the public and information sphere, why they would be so brazen in this attack, is if they were getting the tacit, if not tacit, or tacit, if not outright, support of two major nation states, primarily being Russia and Iran, saying, we've got your back, we're going to support you, we're going to make sure that Iron Dome is not functioning properly when you launch these rockets so that you have great effect. And then you've got China who steps in, which, if I'm reading the tea leaves right, I don't think China is involved in this, but they're certainly capitalizing on it as China is wont to do. And they are trying to sow divisive information, and they're trying to capitalize on the idea that, oh, Joe Biden and his stance and Obama's stance towards Israel and towards Palestine is the reason why Hamas was so brazen. Or President Trump would have, you know, didn't support the Israelis enough, and that's why Hamas was so brazen, or that's why Putin is backing Hamas. All of which is bullshit. I mean, all of which is, whether there is an iota of truth in it or not, is irrelevant. It's the fact that you have Chinese misinformation actors that are intentionally sowing this type of disinformation in an effort to divide us over any activity, any geopolitical event that occurs. And we're seeing it right now. But so our adversaries are either very much directly involved in this conflict, in the atrocities that are occurring in Israel, or they're using it to harm us. And we need to open our eyes to it.
Chase, let's talk about the solutions. We've explored the horrors that are taking place in our own system and around the world. Second part of our book, we talk about solutions. And so we talk about the need for a centralized Department of Digital Services in the U.S. government. We talk about the need for the private sector to begin thinking about the security of their IT systems, which they, right now, they're playing an elaborate game of musical chairs, basically, that let's get an insurance policy, let's hire cybersecurity advisors, let's have outside lawyers. And so if there's an incident, it's cheaper to force it all off on the insurance company to pay for it. That's cheaper than building systems that resist outside penetration. And you helped us with the software chapter in our book. You know that open source software is at the heart of much of the software we use, and we frankly don't know where it comes from. So we need much better software development. And so there's so many things we need that are tangible responses to the mess that we're in, that there's not enough attention, I don't believe, to Americans sitting down and saying, what's gone wrong and how can we fix this? That's what I don't hear much of at all. And we hope our book starts some of those conversations.
Yeah, I think your book will start some of those conversations. I'm a little hesitant to have the government decide to start another branch, because there's been talk of like a cyber branch now and whatever else. Because that the concern I have with all that is, anytime we do that, you start with more bureaucracy and more reallocation of funds and new title authorities and whatever else. I think it's useful, but that's a concern that I have. But I think too, and this goes back to a few years ago, one reason why I would never mess with the Israelis, and I think that they did a good job of showing what deterrence and cyber looks like. Hezbollah was attacking some government sites in Israel, and they were basically defacing. Israel, being the badasses that they are, decided, you know what, I'm tired of this shit, and they just blew up the building where the guys were in punching the keys. And guess what? No more website defacements. So, you know, I'm of the opinion, because of you know, being in the space and knowing what's going on, until you start really putting some heat on the individuals that are getting away with this stuff, Mike, to your point, ransomware operators and whatever that are sitting in places where we know physically where they are, until you start putting actual physical kinetic heat on those individuals, like you said, they're not going to get extradited. They're just making money. Who cares? However, take out one building full of ransomware operators with a tomahawk and watch the rest of them kind of go, well, holy shit. Like, we just changed the game here a little bit. And until we do that, it's not going to happen. And it, tangentially to that, if we had, I don't know, guys in boats off the coast of the U.S., hundreds of them attacking our banks, we would sink the boats. Like, we would sink the boats. But because of these other, you know, crazy, weird cyberspace and lack of title authorities and et cetera, we just let it play out. And until we do something, really do something, it's not going to make a lick of difference. That's my opinion.
Yeah. And Chase, you're not wrong. It's the challenge that you run into is international law. Like, in general, that's why we are not able to do that, is because you're talking about conducting a kinetic strike in the sovereign territory of another nation. And Russia knows this. They know that we're not going to do that, because suddenly they're the victim. If we launch a tomahawk at a building full of Russian ransomware actors that are targeting our critical infrastructure, our hospitals, our financial sector, MGM Casino and Hotel in Las Vegas, if we launch something in response or we conduct a targeted killing, suddenly we're the bad guys. Under international law, we would be the aggressor, and Russia would actually have the right to self-defense and to use kinetic force in response. We would be the aggressor. We would be at fault. And so international law currently doesn't account for this type of proxy war that we're currently seeing. And Russia and China having seats on the Security Council are never going to vote in such a way that the U.S. or the West would be able to respond in kind, or to aggregate these irresponsible actions that we're seeing from any of our adversaries and say, okay, maybe an individual thing that you're doing, you know, maybe NotPetya wasn't an act of war. Maybe, you know, WannaCry for North Korea, maybe that wasn't an act of war. But when you start lining up all of these different activities in cyberspace, they're aimed at undermining our political system, undermining our national security, staging backdoors for what would be kinetic strikes in cyberspace. Suddenly you aggregate that, and that looks a whole lot like an act of war, or something that should authorize us to act in self-defense. Right now, we don't do that. Right now, international law has not been applied in that sense for the aggregation of individual acts, which would authorize us to do so. And until that changes, you're right. We're not going to be able to schwack any ransomware actors with a tomahawk.
You know, what's funny too, is if you look back at like the Iran-Contra stuff that was going on in South America back in the 70s and 80s or whatever, we did a really good job. Well, not we did a really good job, but it was mysterious that all these like oil pipelines blew up and piers and whatever else. And it just so happened that there was some CIA guys in the area and crazy stuff like that just went down. I'm still at a loss for why that type of operation is not happening more in this space. I agree. We can't, international law says that's a no-no. Well, we do have clandestine services that can make things go boom. And it's not going to be attributed to us. And I mean, it's just, I don't know. I think we've just gotten to a space in this country geopolitically, morally, et cetera, where we're so afraid of being the bad guy or hurting someone's feelings or whatever else that we're in a weak position. And those other countries, they don't play. They're not, they don't care. So I mean, to me, the Rome is burning, I already think. And it's just how much gas gets put on this fire. And it's happening from cyberspace, which boggles the mind that this is the place where we're supposed to be betterment of mankind, more connection, growth, cure disease, whatever else. But it is gutting the greatest democracy that the world has ever seen.
Chase, do you see a movement toward your zero trust architecture happening? Or are American companies and American IT service providers, is there a trend toward changing the architecture of our IT infrastructure?
Yeah, what's funny is a lot of the organizations that do engage in the ZT stuff, they see a real return on it, and they see that they do get better because it's a strategic value proposition that they're putting in place. And the U.S. government is doing a big thing around ZT. Their plan is to be zero trust emulating by 2030, which is a big deal for the government. They've allocated a couple $1 billion, and it's international as well. But it's going to take a lot of time. And unfortunately, we can never ZT the populace from being idiots. Because as long as they keep buying into the crap that's being fed to them, the thing that worries me is not the technical issues that we face. It's the societal ones and the fact that our youth and everything else is being targeted and manipulated in this whole process.
The top four applications being downloaded in America these days are all Chinese. You have TikTok, Shine, Temu, and a fourth one that is an editing tool for TikTok. So that's incredible that we are allowing these applications to populate throughout our society, and they're all controlled from China.
And I mean, if you go to China, right, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, but from what I understand, if you go to China, the Chinese government doesn't let Chinese people use TikTok the way that we do.
No, they have a different version of it. They have the power to limit the amount of time Chinese young people spend online. I think it's an hour and a half a day. And their version of TikTok, Douyin, I believe it's called, stresses patriotic messages and instructional, educational kinds of things. And they simply would not allow the kind of, I mean, this is called cognitive warfare. Our young people are looking at their screens all day long, looking at dogs dance and looking at baby do the twist or whatever, one shit all day long. And that's a form of cognitive warfare, and they know it. And then as a result, they don't allow that in their own society.
So just to kind of to wrap up here, because we could go for hours on this, but like where do you see this conflict and cyber warfare going in the next, say, by 2030? I mean, is the U.S. basically going to become a digital third world country, or are we going to just hope and pray that things get better? Like, what is the outcome of this, in your opinion and expertise?
Well, we think that it's still possible for the United States to recognize the pattern and respond. We think we've laid that out in the second part of our book. So the where it starts is galvanizing people to recognize that there's a common challenge, and then to persuade all these different actors in America to find it in their common interest to create a response. So that's what we hope to do with the book. And it's never too late in America, I don't think. I'm an optimist that if we recognize a problem and we find ways of responding within the confines and within the constructs of our American values and our American system, it's very powerful. Pearl Harbor, 9/11. So we're at that moment where Americans need to to recognize a pattern and galvanize ourselves to respond. That's what we hope to achieve with this book.
Yeah, and while our book very much focuses on the threat from Russia and China, we are conscious and we want to avoid making them 10 feet tall, right? Russia and China, they have their own bureaucracies, they have their own corruption. I mean, we've seen very, very clearly the failures of the Russian military with the war in Ukraine. We've seen President Xi going after all of the corrupt officials, military, and in the CCP over the past 5-6 years. And so they have corruption. They have bureaucratic issues. China is a country of 1.4 billion people. If you think that's easy to govern, like, it's not. And so all of the issues that we have, all the divisiveness that we have, all of the bureaucratic shortfalls and the hand-wringing that we have, our adversaries have those same issues. The one thing that they have that we don't is the willingness to go beyond that line and to step over that line. We have to be able to recognize that, and we have to be able to innovate such that the line is no longer the issue. And what I mean by that is zero trust is one way of doing it. If we can solve the ransomware problem such that we don't have to make the payments, because you know as soon as they get through the firewall, they're stopping, they're not going to be able to encrypt the data. Or we have every company that's required to have immutable backups. Well, then there's no encryption. Then it's, yeah, they're going to steal the data, but it's not going to take you offline. You're going to have to do the notifications to the government, notifications to the individuals, but the companies are still going to operate. They're not going to be, it's not going to kill a company to get hit with ransomware. Until we get to those points of cybersecurity and we innovate in such a way that we are protecting ourselves and we are at the very basic level, we are going to still be facing a very capable adversary that's willing to go right up to that line and beyond it. And then the other thing I think we really need to consider and has not come into this conversation is both the use of quantum technology, quantum computing on the decryption side of the house, as well as artificial intelligence, not just ChatGPT and large language models for phishing, but artificial intelligence powered bots that are going to be able to immediately scan the network, find the vulnerability, use the right tool to compromise that network, crawl through the network, identify the specific piece of information that you want to capture, like kind of like a fancy capture the flag, but done by AI. But be able to do that in a flash, that's going to give script kiddies and other really non-technical individuals a seat at the table when it comes to conducting advanced ransomware, advanced malicious cyber operations. Until we have tools developed that are going to forestall that, we're going to be in a very, very bad way, because that's coming a lot faster than I think people realize. And so from an innovative perspective, we very much need innovation. And so the STEM programs, what Bill was talking about, educating our youth, developing an engineering program that's looking not just to your traditional engineering, but engineering for artificial intelligence, engineering for quantum computing, and really putting a priority on that. We need to be leaders in the world when it comes to that. And right now we're just not. And that's going to be something that we hearken back to 20, 30 years from now and say there was a tipping point and we missed it.
Yeah, I mean, and just for the record, for the folks that listen to this, none of this is about like singling out a group of people or whatever else. This is geopolitical, this is military, this is intelligence and espionage, whatever else. So I would just like everybody to understand that, because I don't want to get hate mail about it. Like, that's just what's up. It is what it is. So let's be, you know, honest about that and fair with each other. And then, you know, lastly, I want to thank you guys for jumping on here and providing your expertise and insights. And for anybody that does listen to this, I'll put the links to the book. Well, when this goes live, reach out to Bill and Michael and ask them questions, because they're very open and very honest about what they know. And they're two folks that we should be hearing more from. So I appreciate you guys coming on, and we'll get this out to the masses here real soon.
And thank you, Chase, for helping with the book itself.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, Chase.
Disclaimer, the information in this podcast episode, aka episode, is provided for general information purposes only. By listening to this episode, you understand that this is not specific technical guidance from the host. No information contained in this episode should be construed as security advice from the author, host, or guest, nor is it intended to be a substitute for security advice on any particular subject matter. No listener of this episode should act or refrain from acting on the basis of any information included in or accessible through this episode without seeking the appropriate technical or other professional advice on the particular facts and circumstances that are discussed. This podcast is for informational purposes only. All views expressed therein are those of the host and his guest and should not be considered as being endorsed by nor related to the host or the guest's employers.